Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Over the course of the ending of March and the early weeks of April, we conducted a survey online to try and gauge how India or Indians are perceiving the People's Republic of China in the midst of the COVID pandemic. So to discuss this, to discuss the outcomes of the survey and to discuss what might be the reasons why Indians believe this, I have with me Prateek Wagre and Manoj K. Ramani. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
We are recording this bright and early, so if you hear some bird song, please bear with us. But let's get straight to business. Manoj, can you tell us a little bit about the results of the survey?
Okay, so we conducted the survey from March 26th to April 3rd. And it was conducted online, so it was shared on social media, it was emailed, we shared newsletters and so on and so forth. And what we saw was that we had a total of 1299 respondents. Of those, 1,156 were Indian nationals. So overwhelmingly, Indian nationals were responding to this. It was a multiple choice question. There were five multiple choice questions. And essentially, the idea was to gauge how people are looking at the PRC. So I'll just give you a sense of what the questions were and what the answers were. So the first question was very straightforward. Who do you blame this pandemic? So the pandemic on. So the question was, the COVID-19 pandemic is an outcome of what of these five pointers? And the maximum responses, 67% of the people essentially believe that the PRC is to blame in one way or the other. Of this, about 48.7% said that the pandemic is a result of China's failures to stop illegal wildlife trade, contain what was the early outbreak because they sort of covered it up, and lying to the world even today about the scope of the outbreak. But the second highest sort of number in this was 18.2%, which was saying that, well, this is deliberate. China has conducted biological warfare and it wants the virus to spread. So that's the overwhelming thing. In comparison, only 14.5% of people saw their own sort of home countries, which in this case obviously would be India, because the majority of the respondents are Indians. They only saw 14.5% saw that the lack of preparedness or investment in public health by individual countries in themselves was responsible for the spread of the outbreak, or at least in their countries it was. Also, another question which sort of looked at sort of blaming the Chinese was the use of terms like Chinese virus, Wuhan virus, made in China pandemic, whether these are racist or they stigmatize the country, or whether this is okay given that it might be needed in case you want to ensure that China should be held accountable and responsible for all of this. Again, what we saw was that 52.8%, which is over half the respondents, said that no, the use of this term is fine. It's needed to ensure that China doesn't escape responsibility. Whereas the other sort of, remaining bit of 47% essentially saw that, said that it was either not appropriate because, you could just call it COVID-19, that's the name the WHO guidelines approve, or that this is all immaterial, just stop bickering, start getting your act together, countries should stop bickering and start getting their act together. So it tells you a little bit about how the sense of what the sense is towards the Chinese government. And also, another question that I might point out in this context was the one about, has China provided a model to the world in terms of containing this outbreak, given that today much of the anger also is about, oh, look, the Chinese are now going back to work, whereas the rest of the world is shutting down. And how is it that China has contained it? And the Chinese have pushed out this narrative that, we have provided a model and, the world can follow it. In this case, what we saw was that about 65% of people said, nope, the Chinese have not provided any sort of model. Their system is draconian and opaque, and they've actually covered up the true scale of the crisis. Only a tiny, tiny fraction of people said that, perhaps the Chinese have provided a model. That's about 2.5-3%. So that just gives you a sense that there is a lot of public anger in India with regard to China. It has a lot to do with what's happening within the country, but also has a lot to do with Chinese messaging over the course of this pandemic. But that's broadly what the survey talks about. Finally, in terms of, there was a question with regard to India-China relations. And in that, again, what I saw was that there is some degree of nuance. Most people see it as about 48%, 47-48% see it as complex. that there are shared interests and there is competition. Yet the second highest number is the sort of hardline community, about 33% of people who believe that China is fundamentally a threat to India. And then following that is about 13.5% people which believe that India should be looking to decouple from the Chinese economy. This is their primary mood. And that was what the survey tried to guess, gauge, was that what is your primary mood with regard to these issues? And what you can see is that there's lots of anger, there's lots of frustration. And Beijing's sort of narrative of, you know, sort of in some way the charm offensive of providing, you know, masks and, you know, medical supplies and so on and so forth, and pitching themselves as a sort of public health goods provider and a model provider, hasn't really taken hold in India.
There's quite a lot to unpack here. The most interesting thing to me is the fact that Indians don't seem to be falling for Chinese information operations. And it also seems that broader resentments that Indians have had about the India-China relationship are now asserting themselves through this survey, right?
Yeah.
Part of it perhaps might be due to the fact that it's an online audience, people who are already used to seeing Chinese information operations that therefore smell the bullshit. But it's also interesting to think about the possibility of there being a deliberate attempt to kind of make people think that China was responsible, right? Especially the idea that this is bio-warfare and the idea that it's not your native government that's responsible for dealing with a pandemic, but rather an external government whose mismanagement can be blamed for.
I mean, I'm sure Pratik can talk more about this, but I sort of agree with you completely. I think there has been a concerted attempt in at least parts of the Indian mainstream media, but also we're all at home. We all get these incredible WhatsApp messages constantly. And this has been happening for the last, 2.5-3 months now. And to me, in some ways, it's really fascinating how some of this narrative has changed, particularly on social media, because I remember late January, early February, my folks getting WhatsApp messages of, you know, videos showing people sort of lying on the street, seemingly dead, and people saying, oh my God, this is actually what's happening in China. This is how dangerous the virus is. The government is covering everything up. And today, as problematic as the virus is, as dangerous as it is, as sort of sad as the deaths that are happening around the world are, it's nowhere close to what those messages said. Yet, that reflection when people are getting new WhatsApp messages which say stranger things again, it tends to sort of not exist. And I mean, it's just amazing how these messages sort of change and they continue from one set of disinformation to another. And it just sort of, the ecosystem continues.
Now, Pratik, you wrote an article in The Wire recently about the way that Chinese information operations work, right? So can you help us contextualize this a bit? Can you help us understand how is it that China has tried to manipulate international opinion? But more importantly, how does China manipulate domestic opinion? Because I think that's something that we might be seeing in Indian context as well.
Yeah, so in the domestic context, right? It's actually fascinating. So China's always had this policy of sort of flooding you with information domestically, right? There was research that pointed out that this was back in 2017, where they had about 500 million fake posts a year. It was a 2016 study. 500 million fake posts a year talking about, you know, saying positive things about the government. They've also, of course, evolved to the point where domestic apps like WeChat, etc., controversial information just gets censored, right? And researchers have pointed this out, that if you try to send a Winnie the Pooh kind of photo, it doesn't go through. Even in the early days of the coronavirus outbreak, so the Citizen Lab had kind of studied this as well. And they found that posts talking about coronavirus were just not making it to the other end, right? So they had one person in China trying to send a WeChat message to someone in the US, and they displayed screenshots side by side. So, you know, messages show that they've gone, but they just don't reach the other side, right? So it's a combination of narrative control and flooding the market with, information market per se, with counter narratives and drowning the trying to drown the negative news out.
So basically muddying the waters enough that people don't really know whom to ascribe blame to.
Correct. That, exactly. And that's in general, that's the point of information operations, right? It's the idea is not to win. It's just to create enough confusion, enough disorder, information disorder, as you know, per se, so that it's hard to pinpoint what the objective truth is, right? If you're basically you're debating over the facts itself, which is a win for the adversary in quotes in this case, right? Instead of focusing on what actually needs to happen, you're pegged back debating different narratives and different facts. Some of them true, some of them manufactured.
So how does this compare to, like, because the pattern that you're describing seems awfully similar to the way that the Russians, for example, are trying to influence the American 2016 elections, right? Or even what Russia does in Ukraine now. There's this consistent urge to kind of churn up the information ecosystem, make sure that it's difficult to understand precisely what is happening, who is responsible. And since people on social media are constantly being exposed to this barrage of information, it seems like the de facto response is just to lean back on your own biases, your own experiences, which I think explains a great deal about India's response to China right now, right? You just see them leaning into pre-existing grievances that they had with China. But can you help contextualize this internationally?
Yeah, so Russia has been doing, again, this is Russia's bread and butter, per se, information operation, right? It's always been, in the book, Information Wars, Richard Stengel actually attributes the term disinformation to a Russian origin.
Hmm.
And what they've been doing in this case is, there've been targeted operations in Ukraine. And again, the idea generally is just to lower faith in public institutions there. That's the main agenda. They're also pushing out, content in English, Italian, Spanish, Arabic, right, through a bunch of state-linked outlets. And EU versus Disinfo has been tracking this. There was also recently a Reuters report which quoted a part of the, a body of the EU, which is called the European External Action Service, which sort of documented these kind of attempts by various Russian orgs trying to pin this as either a NATO conspiracy or an American conspiracy, saying it's a man-made virus. And it's also interesting to see how some of this is playing out, because some of these Russian news sources are quoting Chinese news sources who are then quoting the Russian news sources back. They just sort of seem to be feeding off each other in that sense, right? And you can see this sort of mirroring in the way China has taken on as well, right? So China's operations on English language social media have kind of evolved, right? Especially since the Hong Kong protests last year. I think that's sort of like seemed to have been like a turning point where they also saw value in trying to get on Twitter and its influence narrative there, right? So we've seen that in this case as well. So in Italy, when the outbreak was sort of at its peak and China was doing some sort of outreach, there was a lot of trends about how China is helping Russia. And it was later analyzed, I think, I think 50% of it was judged to be bot-rated content or bot-generated content.
That's very interesting. So you said that there's two basic factors, right? You have narrative control and basically muddying the waters. It seems like the Russians have a much more limited objective when it comes to trying to shift the narrative on various things, right? Rather than have billions of bots say that Russia is great, Russia is fantastic, which nobody's really going to fall for, they focus on just muddying the waters to the point where distrust is turned instead against domestic institutions. Whereas China seems to be leaning into just really loud messaging about how China is fantastic. I think in your article, you point out the Chinese ambassadors in various countries also doing this. Doesn't really seem like it's taking, right? It doesn't seem like they're succeeding in changing the global narrative about the quote-unquote Wuhan virus.
Yeah, I think Manoj's survey sort of points to some of that, right? That it may not be taking hold as they hope. Nevertheless, they're trying a bunch of different things, right? So you can actually see. So if you look at the Facebook's ad library, you can see orgs like CGTN, etc., trying to push stories that have a positive spin about how China is reacting to the virus. Stanford Policy Center did some research on this as well, and they found a very, you know, they found a stark difference in the way media organizations are tracking this, right? So the China-based ones are talking about rapid recovery and buying the world time, right? Whereas the Western ones are sort of talking about apportioning blame or holding China responsible, or in general, the doom and gloom that the coronavirus has got.
So I agree with everything that Pratik is saying. And I mean, I'm just going to try and contextualize some of the Chinese sort of narrative attempts. I agree also with the fact that the Russian attempt seems to be far more limited than what the Chinese are doing. Because I see the Chinese sort of objective of this operation. There are sort of four broad objectives to me. First is that there is, like Pratik said, you know, focus on the fact that the Chinese have bought the world time. And that entails sort of glossing over the fact that there was an early failure in China, which was systemic, which was structural, which sort of where they failed to identify that this virus is going to be deeply problematic. And rather than focus on that sort of, you know, how do you muddy that? You muddy that with the idea that saying that, well, you know what, detection in a certain place does not imply origin of the virus, or you usurp the legacy of, the doctor, the whistleblowing Dr. Li Wenliang, which they did when they sort of had their massive national mourning. He was among the martyrs who was highlighted. Or you sort of peddle conspiracy theories, right? You know, things like, oh, this was, you know, in September, there were military games in Wuhan, and did the American military bring this, and so on and so forth. So you do some of that, or even there was at a certain point of time, there were stories being peddled about, oh, actually there were sort of strands of this discovered in Italy much before. So Italy probably had the virus earlier on. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that you showcase sort of the efforts that the Chinese have made to conduct, sort of to contain this virus. So, you focus on numbers. This is done through numbers. I mean, it's not a surprise that, you know, the day before Wuhan was to be opened formally, when the sort of curfew was to be lifted on April 8th, that was the first day, 7th of April was the first day when there were zero deaths in China from the coronavirus. So those are not sort of surprising things to happen. And that's not just a coincidence. That's a lot to do with how the narrative is spun with regard to the cases. And then now you focus on economic activity and these sorts of things. There was also an attempt domestically to sort of, spin the narrative by trying to create what was in Wuhan a gratitude campaign where people were asked to be grateful to the party for having taken care of them. And there was a massive backlash against that, and they eventually shelved the campaign. So that's one other objective. The third objective is to sort of focus on China as, you know, projected as a public goods provider, which I've sort of spoken about in the past. The idea is that you create this sense of legitimacy that this is at a point of time where you juxtapose yourself with the Americans and say, look, this is your superpower, this is your big transatlantic partner, and it's shutting down. And it's not really being able to assist anybody, whereas China is providing masks and PPEs and whatever.
I want to ask you about this a little bit, Kamal, because you shared an article a while back about how basically I think a very famous Thai actor and actress tweeted or retweeted something blaming China for the virus, calling it the Wuhan virus or something on those lines, which led to a massive backlash from Chinese social media users, which then led to a backlash from, I think, Thai and Filipino social media users. So it doesn't really feel like China's attempt to project itself as a public goods provider is landing, at least in Asia, which is the region which it seeks to be the hegemon of, ostensibly. So what really are the objectives, or how are they managing to fulfill the objectives that you laid out?
Yeah, I think this is the problem with, you know, state-controlled narrative, and particularly attempts to sort of fashion something like this, is that you do it really badly, or you do an overkill and you end up landing yourself in deep trouble. So this idea of creating this narrative of China being a public health goods provider is obviously problematic, because firstly, if I just go to Europe first and then I come to Asia, in Europe itself, what you saw was that there was a backlash. I mean, there was immediate stresses being placed on the European Union, and European powers like Germany, France, and all were very annoyed with the Chinese propaganda, because their view was that when China needed support in terms of medical supplies and other supplies, Europe had provided support. Germany has shipped in material, France has shipped in material to China through January and February, and it was done very quietly without any sort of propaganda. So the Chinese propaganda sort of grated in Europe. Secondly, the issue in Europe was that when sort of leaders of places like Serbia and all went on to say that, well, the European Union is nonsensical and the solidarity is completely fake. At this point in time, only the Chinese can help us. That has a lot to do with how the geopolitics of that region is shaping up. And you saw the European Union sort of, members of the European Union get really, really annoyed. You had the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, saying things like, there is a narrative propaganda war that's going on at the moment. This is about geopolitics. And all of a sudden, sort of, that narrative starts to build and China starts to sort of lose the credibility that it wants to build by providing these supplies. The other part is, again, the fact of the quality of these supplies. Not all of these supplies are donated. There's lots of purchases that's happening. For example, just yesterday, the Indian sort of embassy in China said that we want to buy 17 million PPE kits and we want to buy them. We are commercially procuring them. So this is not about China being benevolent and donating things. This is business. And that sort of grates in the countries. In Asia, I mean, the case that you raised, I mean, I would encourage people to go and check out this hashtag NNEVYY on Twitter. And what you will see is that there is this propaganda or a narrative war playing out between largely people from Thailand and China and mainland China. And it has to do with, like you said, this actress's tweet and the angry reaction from Chinese Twitter users saying things like, you know, your government is useless and it's your government's failure and so on and so forth. And Thai is essentially responding in very self-deprecating humor, saying that, yes, our government is crap, but the virus came from China. And yes, our government is crap, but Taiwan is independent. Yes, our government is crap, but Hong Kong is not China. And Chinese sort of aggressive nationalists on Twitter just couldn't deal with that sort of humor. And that's led to sort of people from Taiwan, people from Hong Kong who, you know, who find the PRC problematic, those kinds of people sort of joining in and saying that the Thais are showing us the way to deal with Chinese, with the PRC Twitter army sort of thing. But that's one of the sort of outcomes. But I mean, in terms of we've spoken about sort of many ways in which, and Pratik has spoken about how sophisticated some of this stuff can be. But even at the most sort of crude levels, for example, when you're sending in supplies, you've got, and this can be really sweet, you know, but it can also be seen as state propaganda, which is what it is largely. Where when you're sending supplies to different countries, you're putting poems on the boxes of solidarity and all of that and all of that. And that's all great if it happens organically. But when it happens in a sort of structured attempt, along with these other things, to try and shape agendas in those countries, it loses its value because as people start to realize it. And increasingly around the world, people have started to realize. That's why you're seeing structural pushback in Europe and the US particularly, where you know, there are laws being in Europe particularly, there are laws being strengthened to make companies much more secure from takeovers, and there's a concern with regard to that. In the US, there is such a massive conversation about the Chinese responsibility with regard to all of this. There's been at least one or two cases that have been filed to hold China accountable, so on and so forth. The merit of those cases is another matter. But it tells you a little bit about the political and narrative sort of building in these countries, which has a lot to do with the failure of the Chinese narrative. I mean, when they started contesting, when they started pinning blame, when they started spinning conspiracy theories, it got worse for them, to me.
That's a very interesting point. What I would like to dive into is the fact that there's this idea of who's responsible, right? The idea that either China is responsible or that China should be held accountable by changing the name of the virus. It seems more like an expression of domestic discontent that is being consciously or unconsciously channeled against China as the big bad in this case, right? So it's interesting to see how in one case China's state-led narrative control efforts are failing internationally, but also kind of shows, at least to me, it seems that domestic governments or national governments are starting to understand how China plays the game, how China manages to use information and misinformation to gain domestic political legitimacy. And at least for me, looking at the way that hashtags around the, you know, the Chinese virus erupted in India, it's difficult to think that there might not be a political hand behind this, or at least a domestic political hand. What do you think, Pratik?
Yeah, so in fact, you should know, strange as it is, I think one of the people who started doing something like this on the international stage and profited was Donald Trump, right? Right from his campaign, he really went after China when it suited him. But you know, coming to the point about India, so it was kind of fascinating to see around 24th, 25th March, the term Chinese virus 19 was trending in India, right, for pretty much 1 or 2 days, until it was taken over by another hashtag. We'll get to that. But you know, it was used along with things like Chinese bioterrorism, China light, people died, Chinese virus, corona, and you could. So you could just see from the nature of a lot of these tweets, right? It was very obviously coordinated activity, right? Given that they were pretty much identical tweets. Some of those activities spilled over to Instagram as well, though not as widespread there, right? So that's interesting to watch out for, because that tells you that Instagram is also going to be a source, or you know, a location where you're going to have see a lot more information operations play out. We saw that with Iran, right, in the immediate aftermath of the Soleimani assassination.
They were doing stuff on Instagram.
Yeah, and Instagram actually had to. I think Instagram was flooded with pro-Iran content, and Instagram actually, Facebook actually took down a number of accounts when that happened, right? And it we're digressing a little, but it was interesting because they justified that as them, you know, just basically sticking by the American line on sanctions. It was strange because, you know, what sparked it suddenly, it was fairly obvious. But anyway, so coming back to this point, right? So it was interesting to see how this coordinated activity sort of took over. Manoj spoke a bit about those WhatsApp messages as well, right? That all of us got. This took form in other ways as well. Early April, there was banned TikTok in India. That sort of movement tried to take on. It wasn't as, I don't think it caught on as much as the Chinese virus aspect of it. But you know, you could tell that, you know, it was very clearly directed at a domestic audience, and I looked through hundreds and many hundreds of tweets in those days, and it was just incredible to see some of the patterns. Couple of interesting things emerged to me, right? While there were a lot of identical tweets, there were also enough with very very tiny variations, right? So that it gives you a sense that even the Indian operations are evolving a little bit. And another thing you could look at it is that a lot of this feeling was organic, right? As you alluded to, that it's just other grievances that are now finding a way to vent out in this context.
Yeah, what is most interesting to me is our survey, as Manoj's survey result, saying that 52.8% of people think that the term Chinese virus or Wuhan virus or made in China pandemic are needed to ensure that China doesn't escape responsibility. And that to me just seems like nothing more than a tantrum, you know, because changing the label does not really hold China accountable in any meaningful sense of the word. It's quite literally an expression of frustration, which a hashtag has very elegantly managed to tap into. But it's I think it's quite interesting that you mentioned that these are basically previous grievances that are being exacerbated by either coordinated or uncoordinated information operations, right? Because we saw very, very soon after that a new hashtag trending. And I think that if we were to conduct the same survey now and ask people who they think is most responsible for the spread of the virus, they would probably say the Tablighi Jamaat. And we saw very soon, at least for me, even though it does not seem to have been as coordinated, the massive amount of attention that Tablighi Jamaat got, partially absolutely justified, but it also seemed like it tapped into a pre-existing sort of grievance that has been built over years by a wide variety of actors to create grievances against Muslims, which then exploded organically or inorganically to the point where I am now flooded with messages on my WhatsApp groups, for example, that are either directly or indirectly blaming the Tablighi Jamaat. You see, even though state governments like Tamil Nadu, for example, are referring to it as, quote-unquote, a single source event and not like naming it, It feels like there is an undercurrent of public anger about the government's management or mismanagement of the response that has been very elegantly kind of diverted towards a particular community. So those are my views on it. What do you think?
So my thought on this is that it's, yes, I mean, most governments are going to essentially look at trying to manage this by finding fault somewhere else. Because it's very difficult politically to sell something like it's a natural event and there are structural causes for, you know, spreads and things like that. And again, it's an unprecedented event, so it's very difficult for governments to sort of find ways to escape responsibility. And you're seeing that in India in many which ways. I mean, I think this issue of the Tablighi Jamaat in India, while important, while problematic and all of that, I think that it's the problem has been that it's been looked at beyond a health, from a healthcare prism to a communal prism, which is problematic. And it's happened even in mainstream media. It's not just a social media phenomenon. And I do think that there is obviously vested interest that lies in doing that. To my sense, for most governments, it's interesting for us to see how different governments spin the narrative. So at the moment in India, the narrative has spun from, say, the Jamaat to China and things like that. And also comparing the fact that, look, we are better off right now in terms of numbers than most countries, particularly the United States and the developed West. So I think those are ways in which that narrative works. In the West, if you see, in the US, if you see, you have Lindsey Graham, who's very close to Trump himself, and members of the Republican Party, very clearly saying things like, you know, the Chinese are responsible for so many deaths in America, 16,000-17,000 deaths. Today, there are about 22,000. But the idea the Chinese are responsible directly for these deaths and they should be held accountable and things like that. And that tells you what we're going to expect going forward, particularly it's an election year in America. So I shudder to think what would have happened if this was last year in India heading into elections. In China, if you see, actually, the narrative is completely, sort of domestic narrative is completely different. I mean, the New York Times did a scraping of Chinese media on Twitter, and they had these three broad objectives that they identified. The idea was to protect China's image broadly, dispute the origin of the virus, and thirdly, spin optimism. And this optimism has a lot to do with domestic sort of narrative. So if you just scan through Chinese websites, news websites over the last 15, 20 days, ever since the sort of peak of the virus passed in China and they started declaring some sort of, you know, victory, what you would see is that a lot of the images were about, you know, people celebrating, people happy, life getting back to normal, medics going back from Hubei and Wuhan. And in that process of going back, sort of expressing grief, hugging, crying, thanking each other and those sorts of things. So a lot of that was about spinning this positive sense of, you know, how we have overcome this very difficult period and it's because of the party sort of thing. So different governments are operating at different levels. I have a sense that once and hopefully soon, when we get to this stage in India where we feel that life can sort of resume to whatever our new normal will be, you will see similar sort of optimism being spun about how this was about decisive leadership, this was about so and so forth. The cynic in me tells me that that is what will happen and that will get politicized.
Cynic in me can already see it happening right away on Indian social media.
Yeah, so I guess some of this will happen even more as we reach that point where, and you can see some similar graph as to what's happening in China. That would be my assumption. But Pratik, please go ahead.
Yeah, so specifically, Arnold, you brought up the point about the Tamil Nadu government, right? Calling it single source. And I think that's a responsible thing for them to do. But again, if you look at the response to that, right, and it just tells you that, right, information operation never end, right? They never rest. The moment that went out, you saw a whole bunch of activity again on Twitter saying, you know, what is this single source? Why are you not calling it what it is, right? So even that activity sort of exercised responsible speech, right, was spun into a rallying point for an operation. So it's. It's really interesting because, you know, you just tend to wonder, right, then, you know, what is the way to actually to resolve these kind of situations, right? Because a lot of what we saw happening with the way the whole Tablighi Jamaat thing was reported, it falls very, very neatly into the dangerous speech framework, right? And, you know, I'd encourage people to look it up, and then mainly. It has a frame, you know, the framework talks about five different elements. So there is a speaker, a message, a social and historical context, the medium, and the audience, right? Now, I won't go into actually explaining it. based on the title, right, you can see a sense of how that over time, right, the dehumanization attempts, etc., right, that we sort of see playing out, mm-hmm. how over time that has very, very real consequences, right? And it was also interesting to see how people with liberal views, right, and I'm saying that in quotes because it means the term liberal now means different things to different people, were equally vociferous in their criticism of the Tablighi Jamaat, right? And yeah. again, while I sort of see their point, it's also important to contextualize it in something like, you know, the dangerous speech aspect and see the kind of downstream effects that can have. There was a very specific piece by Veer Sanghvi, right, who talked about how the liberals are hurting themselves with this, and that had me conflicted, right? Because on the one side, you sort of say that yes, there is room to criticize what happened, but given the context in India, right, how vocal should you be about that criticism? Because you have seen that it has knock on effect, right? We saw in the immediate aftermath there were a lot of videos, right? and it turned out a bunch of them was outright malinformation, right? Videos from other countries being you know, passed off as activity in India, right? To people supposedly spitting on food, spitting on the streets, this and that. There was a whole bunch of videos. A lot of them have been debunked. Now, it's still an open question whether the ones that are out there are, you know, whether they're authentic or whether they're out of context. But the point is that, you know, as soon as they get out there, their work is sort of done already, right? Even though the fact check comes, how many people are actually...
Yeah, you muddy the waters, you tap into public discontent, you create enough attention around this issue to make it seem like this is the only thing, the single biggest thing that has caused the spread of the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was also this interesting article by, it was by the Democratic Authority UK, and they were looking at how, you know, trying to figure out parameters on which nations are susceptible to disinformation, right? And it was more in the foreign disinformation operation context, but I think it sort of applies even for domestic operation, right? And some of the things they identified were, you know, societal polarization, right? The higher that is, the less likely you are to be resilient to online disinformation, right? Or said in a different way, the more likely you are to fall for disinformation things, right? And this sort of manifests itself in mistrust of expert knowledge, right? Belief in conspiracy theories and anti-elitism. Right? You can see shades of that.
I can see colors of that.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Trust in news media is another thing that they highlighted, right? Again, you know, very, very apparent in India, right? The other point was... about the sort of different entry points that information has, right? In the sense that the more likely you are to consume news from different sources, the more likely you are to be susceptible to disinformation. Right? And in this case, read different sources at different WhatsApp groups as well, right? It's not just necessarily a variety of news outlets, but if you know, social media, messaging, those kind of networks as well. The more such networks you have, the more entry points you have for disinformation and conspiracy theories.
It's eerie how well this might work in Indian context, given that, for example, we're among the world's biggest users of WhatsApp. We are constantly receiving information from multiple WhatsApp groups, often which are very personal. I think the BBC had an interesting report on how this spreads in India and pointed out that in India there's a tendency to take things at face value if they come from a relative, especially an older relative, for example. And it's very fascinating to think about the sheer scale of this operation. It's evidently, as Manoj pointed out, it's in somebody's interest. It's been being developed over years. The way that the Tablighi Jamaat exploded into the hashtag Corona Jihad is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just one manifestation of that happening. It seems like a very powerful way for elected officials to kind of deflect responsibility for dealing with the crisis, right? Because now that that ecosystem is there, now that that polarization is there, now that distrust of experts is there, personally, it's a little worrisome to me that given that the Indian state is already not the most transparent of beasts, how they might in future use this kind of domestic narrative control, this domestic mudding of waters, this domestic finding of enemies to kind of deflect public attention from things that need to be done.
Yeah, that's one interesting aspect, right? You mentioned Corona Jihad hashtag, and I was also looking at that. So I was using the tool called Hoaxy to sort of see how tweets with that hashtag are sort of spreading, right? And it was interesting. So initially it was a lot of mainly unknown accounts. I think after the third or fourth day, it was surprising to see that a lot of the Corona Jihad tweets, that, the one that used that hashtag, were linked to Rana Ayu, right? And that's because she wrote an article, right, talking about this thing. But the fact that she used the hashtag in her tweet also gave it a lot of mileage, right? And it continued to stay on, to stay trending after the initial period because of the counter narrative, right? But partly because of the counter narrative, I should say. But it still sort of fueled that, right? You would still see that in your Twitter trends, right? And you click on it and you'd be exposed to this whole barrage of bigoted communal content. So
Somebody tried to use the hashtag to debunk it.
Exactly, right? That's the point. Trying to spread awareness, right, is also sort of adding to it, right? So it's very, I'm a little bit at a loss for words there because it's kind of perplexing, right? Because then it brings you back to the question that, hey, what is the way around this, right? Because this susceptibility to information disorder is not so much of just a supply side thing. It's probably as much a demand side thing that people want this kind of information. So how do you counter that? And I think that's a question that we need to find a way to address.
Very good point. Manoj, any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think Pratik has summed up everything. I mean, we had a very serious conversation. I just had a joke to sort of end it with, which was that perhaps one way to do is social media distancing. That could be kind of useful in this.
Okay, cool. Thank you guys so much for this interesting conversation. And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.